ॐ ज्ञानतिमिरन्धस्य ज्ञानञ्जनाशलाकाय चक्षुरुन्मीलितं येन तस्मै श्रीगुरवे नमः.
We're continuing our ongoing discussion about strong sadhana, because it's something that we can do something about. There are many things in this world we can't do anything about, and those things we can leave alone and we can tolerate. For those of you who are joining us online this morning, we welcome you, and you can text in at 650-255-2227. That's 650-255-2227. The operators are standing by to take your calls, your texts. So please participate in the class. Also, you'll notice on the website a number that you can dial in so you can speak to the members of this assembly live through the conference call and the telephone. It's easy. And we'd love to hear from you. And thank you for joining us online this morning. And welcome to all of you who have come from various places all over the Bay Area and all over California to join us live here in the studio this morning. And we're going to, over the next couple days, talk about strong sadhana. And just on Wednesday night, we talked a little bit about some of the qualities of sadhana as an introduction to the topic. And one of them as a review was Pashanera Reka, strictness in practice. And this Pashanera Reka refers to lines in stone. The definition of strict is tighten, draw tight. When a musical group practices a lot and then they make a good performance, afterwards, the members of the band will come together and say, that was tight, or others will say, that was tight. Tight performance. Otherwise, without practice, they may be sloppy. Of course, people may be so intoxicated, they don't notice. But generally, those who are connoisseurs of music will notice that someone has practiced or not practiced. One of the great violinists of the world, I mentioned the other day, Joshua Hevitz, says that if I don't practice one day, I notice it. If I don't practice 2 days, then my teacher notices it. And if I don't practice 3 days, then everybody notices it. And practice, for those who are serious about a discipline, is a daily affair. And one begins to notice whether or not one is tight or not. And this mindfulness of one's strictness or tightness in one's practice is of great concern to those who are interested in advancing in any discipline. They actually measure it and they notice from day to day whether they're tight or they're not tight. And they try to discern why. And this is in the topic of strictness. So one of the words Prabhupada frequently used when he talked about the practice of bhakti is that one must be strict. So it's worthwhile looking into this word strict. What does it mean? In context, I gave the phrase Pashanera Reka, which means lines in stone, which is a reference to the practice of Raghunath Das Goswami, who Kaviraj Goswami, the author of Sri Chaitanya Charitamrita, says Raghunath Das's practice, daily practice, was like lines in stone. In other words, immovable and very structured. So these are the greatest of practitioners. They're strict. It's not that when one reaches a certain level, one simply abandons the process or thinks, I don't need to practice anymore, and becomes lax. Even those who don't need to practice do it anyway in order to set an example for others. Another word that Prabhupada uses in context with practice is serious. And the definition of serious, It's a Latin word, which is shingere, earnest. Earnestness, demanding a seriousness, is defined in the dictionary as demanding careful application. Demanding careful application. Demanding careful application. Those three words in and of themselves form a sutra which we can benefit from thinking about. Why is it demanding? Well, if we don't have careful application of the process, then we'll be swept away, because Maya is very demanding, extremely demanding. She'll ask us to do things that we never thought that we should do or that we want to do, but she'll demand that we do them anyway. And in his book, The Art of the Start, the great entrepreneur Guy Kawasaki, who was one of the founders of Apple, talks about how in forming a corporation, one must frame or be framed. That is, unless you frame the company, what its purposes are, and you apply those on a regular basis, then someone will come along and frame it for you. In fact, in the founding of Apple, that there was a great struggle in the beginning, because although Steve Jobs, Steve Wozniak, and a bunch of other hippie kids started off the Apple Corporation, there was a way in which when they had a modicum of success, others, corporate types, came in and started taking the company a different way, and there was great internal struggle. There's always great internal struggle. Everyone wants to define or redefine whatever you're doing, and therefore you must, on a regular daily basis, frame what you're doing and understand how serious it is and be demanding of the application of your purpose. This is seriousness. Also, seriousness means substantial in terms of size, number, or quality. Substantial in terms of size, number, or quality. So this is another meaning of serious. So someone, that's a serious practice. Why? Because he's doing it a lot. He's doing it all the time. There's enough there that you can see that the person's serious about it. They're consumed by it. That they're exhibiting their purpose in life, because the quality of it is so good. It's serious. So you can see seriousness in a person if the size, the number, or the quality is apparent. And also we mentioned that in the Bhagavatam, first canto, second chapter, 12th verse, there's a mention of thoughtfulness that comes into one's practice as an extension of earnestness, which is an aspect of seriousness, earnestness, that one must be thoughtful in one's practice. And finally, sincerity. So these three words, strict, serious, and sincere, everyone say? Yeah. And sincere means clean or pure. From san, without, sere, wax. Without wax, because early on in the cultivation of the quarries in which marble was being taken, the most valuable marble was that white marble with no lines. And those mining the marble soon discovered a way to erase the lines by chiseling them out and then filling them with wax, and therefore getting a little bit more for the cheaper marble. However, that didn't last, because after using the marble and on a hot day, the wax melted and then the lines became apparent again. So in sincerity, there's a way in which what you see is what you get. It's free from pretense or deceit. Free from pretense or deceit, proceeding from genuine feelings. So be who you are. Don't try to do or pretend, don't try to pretend that you're something that you're not. Be sincere. Start from the level that you're at now and apply what you can apply now. Don't cheat. Don't present yourself as more than you are. It won't help. Just be sincere. Be where you're at. And actually, there's a way in which people come to the rescue. If you simply admit the level that you're at, that you're on, and practice as diligently as possible from that level, people will appreciate and they'll come to help you. If you practice to deceive and present yourself as more than you are, then people will either they'll realize that you're cheating, or they'll think, oh, he doesn't need my help because he's already so advanced. So be sincere. And we also talked about how Krishna responds to sincerity. It's the most valuable substance in the universe. You can't buy it at Gulab Singh and Chandi Chowk, even though he sells little bottles of essential oil for as much as $20,000. If you go in and you ask for one drop of pure sincerity, he won't be able to deliver, even if you give him $1 million. That is something that is so valuable because it comes from oneself, one's own inner determination that I'm going to bear my soul to the Lord and to the devotees, to my spiritual master, and I'm going to practice at the level I'm at as diligently, as strictly, as seriously as possible, and I'll go on even though I'm incapable at this point of doing much. I'll do what I can. There's much that can be said about sincerity, but in one sense it's intuitive and becomes self-evident when one makes the decision within oneself that I'm going to practice Krishna consciousness. I'm going to surrender to Krishna, even though I can't do it. I'm going to surrender. And in that very instant, Krishna comes to the rescue because he's eternally attentive to the soul's attitude of surrender. And when that attitude makes its appearance, even the slightest glimmer, then Krishna responds because he knows what's best for the soul and he's always looking for that reciprocation. The opposite is described in the Shastra, that the living entity has turned his face away from the Lord and is in an adverse situation. Asmitihi. His intelligence is contrary to his best interest. And he looks away from the Lord. He doesn't turn with sincere feeling and say, I'm going to surrender come hell or high water, even though at this point it's very difficult for me. So Gajendra mentions this in his prayers, that the Lord is never inattentive. This is of great consolation to the practitioner, that as soon as I decide sincerely to turn my attention towards Krishna, he's there. There's no gap. He's there eternally. He's there perfectly, always with a complete willingness to assist us. In fact, as Prabhupada mentions in the verse Srinvatam Swakata Krishna, verse 17 in the second chapter of the first canto, Krishna wants us to come back to Godhead far more than we want to come back to Godhead. This is apparent in the story of Gopakumar, by the way, in the Brihat Bhagavatamrita, that when Gopakumar visits Vaikuntha in a circuitous way on his way to Goloka Vrindavan, he meets Lord Narayan. And Lord Narayan says, I've been waiting for you for so long, life after life. I was wondering, when were you going to turn your attention towards me? And he said, I thought in this life, surely he'll take to devotional service. Surely he'll try to surrender. But you didn't. And you went on and on and on. He said, finally, I had enough. I couldn't wait, so I forced you to take birth in Govardhan. And then I appeared there personally as your spiritual master, and I intervened in your life, even though this is contrary to my statement, Samaham Sarvat Bhuteshu. That's how much Krishna wants us to come back to Godhead. And also, in that section, he mentions how grateful he is to a living entity who surrenders even an iota, even in scintilla of sincere surrender, that Krishna becomes grateful to the living entity, that he's so appreciative of that surrender. So remember that. We can remember that as we continue our practice. It only requires a trace of sincerity. Atapi te deva padambuja dvaya prashada leshanu grihita evahi. A lesha means a fragment, a molecule of mercy of the Lord can bring us to the highest position. And on the other side, just a molecule, a scintilla of sincere feeling or intention of surrender can attract that mercy to the living entity. So strict, serious, and sincere are three words that we can carry with us in our pocket and bring out regularly and introduce to the unruly wild mind that says, let's just do whatever we like. And isn't it a good idea just to stay in the material world and so forth? And no, strict, serious, and sincere practice brings the greatest profit and benefit and happiness to the soul. The opposite brings ruination. It brings the loss of freedom. There are so many downsides to following the unruly, undisciplined mind that one could write volumes about it. And volumes have been written about it by the great Vaishnavas, talking about how following the mind has caused them untold misery and how dangerous it is to simply comply with the whimsical impulses of the mind or the senses, which have their own brains, according to Bill, what is his name? Not Bill Moyer. Who is the one who does all these documentaries about on PBS? Bill Moyers? Yeah, the gastric brain, the digestive system has almost as many nerve endings as your brain does. That means that your stomach, your intestines, your tongue, your esophagus have a mind of their own, so watch out. If you don't take higher dictation, they have an idea. They have a plan, which is to go on eating and go on eating whatever they like. Ramananda.
What is actually the difference? It looks to me strict and serious. They both appear to be the same. Are very closely related. What's the difference?
Study the subtleties. In the subtleties, just like in poetry, when you go into the subtlety of the words, every word has some weight and some value and some very subtle difference. That's why I like to look at the etymology. If you go deeply, if you drill down deeply enough, you'll find the origin and the circumstance of each word has a slightly different context. And in that, your mind can find a little bit of ananda in the variety. And then you can appreciate it, you know, the differences. So in these cases, strictness is defined as to tighten. And even the word itself has a kind of onomatopoeic quality to it. Strict. It's like, there's a line there. Don't go over it. Come back here, mind, right now. Stay in this. We're here now, let's stay in it. Strict. Serious is earnestness, according to the etymology and so forth. There's a little bit of difference between earnestness and the idea of tightening. Like that.
And I also have one comment. The comment is that in the last class you were mentioning about types of distractions, and one of the distractions you mentioned was continuous distraction.
Yes.
And today when you are talking about the violin skills, I just remembered that even the skills we have, the knowledge we have, is continuously being destroyed.
Yes.
practice it again.
That's true. So we have to renew every day. And this is something mentioned by Uddhava, by Krishna to Uddhava in the Uddhava Gita, 11th canto of the Srimad Bhagavatam. And Krishna says that although I'm constantly giving instructions and bringing the Vedas to light in the material world, they're constantly being, the message is constantly being distorted. Constantly. I mean, even Prabhupada was so careful to repeat this message, don't change anything. Be careful, don't change the message. And he was extremely attentive to the assembly of devotees who had started a slightly different kind of kirtan. Stop it. Go back to the... don't do that. Or even things that he introduced, like we said, Bhaja Sri Krishna Chaitanya. To Prabhupada, just, he would notice the feeling or the way in which devotees were doing it and say, okay, don't do that anymore. It's not strict enough. It's not serious enough. It's not. There's something wrong with that. And through history, we've seen... you can read in the book Sri Bhaktisiddhanta Bhaibhav by His Holiness Bhaktivikas Swami about the many different kinds of deviation from Lord Chaitanya's teachings of Gaudiya Vaishnavism. There are literally dozens of various distinctive deviations. And then, of course, there's subcategories of all those as well. Groups that formed after Chaitanya Mahaprabhu that went off in slightly different directions, which is the nature of the conditioned mind and soul, conditioned mind and heart, which is, let's just do it my own way. I'll do my own thing rather than follow the strict path. I'll do it a different way. So we have to be careful of that because the independent mind can take one astray. And by carefully following, although not fanatically, but by carefully following the mood and mission of the acharya, then one can become transparent and empowered in practicing Krishna consciousness and carrying it forward to others. Otherwise, one loses one's potency. Nice points, Ramananda Sakar Prabhu. Thank you. Okay, now we talked about grabbers, how planets are all called grahas or grabbers. They grab us, they move in a different direction. All living entities are grabbers. And so if you're going to be grabbed, then get grabbed by someone who knows where they're going. Anugraha. Anugraha means mercy. This is the translation of anugraha, which you'll find throughout the Bhagavatam. Anugraha. So graha means grabber. Anu means to follow. So devotees are grabbers also. That's why they preach. They go out and they grab people and say, hey, come here, look at this, read that, don't read this, read that, chant this, don't chant that. This is anugraha. It means that you grab someone and you cause them to follow in the right way. Yesterday, I went on book distribution with Nirkula down to San Francisco State University, and just as we got out of the car, there's no lack of opportunity to preach anywhere in the Bay Area, that's for sure. We got out of the car, just walking down the street, we stopped about six people before we got to the campus, actually. And the first person I stopped was a worker. He spoke Spanish, I think about 80%, 20% English, and he bought a book. And then I walked a little further. We walked a little further, and then we found that he was part of a whole crew working on somebody's front yard there. So then I talked to the foreman, the boss, who was, I could tell just by his body language that he was in charge of the whole thing. So we had at least a 10-minute conversation with him, and he looked at the Bhagavad Gita, he said, I'm a dogmatic Christian. I said, we're all dogmatic. You can't live in this world without being dogmatic. I said, this whole university, every class you step into, you're forced to be dogmatic because you can't go back and test every theory that's ever been postulated and passed on. You have to accept axiomatic truth. It's just the way it is. He was impressed by that. And then he gave the Gita back. He said, I'm a Christian. I can't take this. Oh, he said, oh, no problem. We'll give you the Christian book. So I handed him over a book I just happened to pack with me called The Four Principles of Freedom, written by Satyaraj Prabhu about following the four regular principles. And on the front, it talks about chastity. It talks about... I forget the different terminologies he uses for the four regular principles, but it looked kind of Christian. He looked at it, and I was watching his mind scan the thing, and it didn't reject. His mind didn't reject. And okay, so we kept talking. And anyway, now I've forgotten the point I'm trying to make. Yeah, about being dogmatic, huh? Yeah, about the grabbers and so forth. So then, so I kept talking to him and preaching just on subtle points. Like one point he made was that he said he was trying to get his nephew to be a Christian, but his nephew was a seeker, and he said he's open to everything. And he said, and he told his nephew, he said, you know, you can't be open to everything in the beginning, maybe, he said, but at some point, it's just like you have to get married, and then there's only one woman in your life. And then and I said, yeah, but that doesn't mean that all other women become irrelevant after that. Doesn't mean you don't talk to any other women, right? Because I was making the point, like, you can also read this book, because, so after about 10 minutes of this back and forth, he decided to give a donation very spontaneously. And then he said, but I want that book. And he wanted the Gita back, even though I took it away from him, you know. So this is anugraha. It's, through just presenting what I've heard from Prabhupada and, in other ways that present just tit for tat, his intelligence got attracted, and he actually spontaneously gave a donation, and he wanted the book back, even though his mind rejected it. This is anugraha. We grabbed him and caused him to follow. And then of course, you know, Srila Prabhupada will take it from there. He takes the book home and starts looking at the pictures and things like that. That's going to grab somewhere, anugraha. So beware of grabbers. In your life, everyone's going to try to grab you. In fact, have you ever noticed when you have a cold, everyone will tell you, everyone's a doctor? Someone was telling me this in Govardhan. I said, notice that the one profession, everyone wants to be a doctor. Just notice, because every time you get sick, everyone will tell you how to get better. And they'll all have their own cure. It's like everyone has this tendency. So notice it. And be aware of the fact that everyone's grabbing you in a certain direction. Be selective and who the grabbers are. Karanath Prabhu.
I was just reading in the last chapter of the first canto when Maharaj Parikshit went to the bank of the river and all the sages came there. And Srila Prabhupada says in the purport that just like different doctors have different remedies, similarly, all the different sages have different prescriptions Perfect. For spiritual life. But then Shukadeva Goswami came and everyone recognized that he was meant to recite the Bhagavad.
Perfect. Perfect. Yes. We have a text that's just come in. You can text in at 650-255-2227.
And this is from Shyamarupa Das, Sacramento.
Jai.
And he asks that how to avoid being hard-hearted while trying to be strict at the same time.
How to avoid being hard-hearted while being strict at the same time. Well, one way is to realize that whatever ability we have to be strict is coming from Krishna. And I'd like a Bhagavad Gita, if I could. Because I read something the other day that here's one.
Thank you.
That really attracted my attention regarding practice. And this is in the 12th chapter where Krishna is talking about the process of devotional service. And he tells in text 6 and 7 that those who worship me, giving up all their activities unto me and being devoted to me without deviation, that's strictness, engaged in devotional service and always meditated upon me, that's strictness, having fixed their minds upon me, O son of Prita, for them I am the swift deliverer from the ocean of birth and death. So the last clause is that for them I am the swift deliverer from the ocean of birth and death. And in the purport, Prabhupada mentions that when one takes to the process of devotional service very strictly, that Krishna, when one surrenders to Krishna, then Krishna takes charge of one's advancement in devotional service. Let me see if I can find the exact. The responsibility is taken by the Supreme Lord himself. He clearly states here that he himself becomes the deliverer. A child is completely cared for by his parents, and thus his position is secure. Similarly, a devotee does not need to endeavor to transfer himself by yoga practice to other planets. Rather, the Supreme Lord, by his great mercy, comes at once, riding on his bird carrier, Garuda, and at once delivers the devotee from material existence. Although a man who has fallen into the ocean may struggle very hard and may be very expert in swimming, he cannot save himself. But if someone comes and picks him up from the water, then he is easily saved. Similarly, the Lord picks up the devotee from this material existence. One simply has to practice the easy process of Krishna consciousness and fully engage himself in devotional service. So if one remembers, thank you, that although one's being strict, Krishna is the one who is delivering, and that one does not become proud or simply attached to being strict, but is attached to being strict for the sake of showing to Krishna that one is sincere, then the heart doesn't become hard. If one practices severe austerities just for the sake of the austerities and doesn't remember that Krishna is the deliverer, then the heart can become hard. Rupa Goswami mentions this in the Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu. Akurnath Prabhu.
I've been hearing a lot of devotees talking lately, there's always these fads that come by and stuff like that. But a lot of devotees are talking that, you know, the raganuga bhakti that's practiced in the spontaneously in Vrindavan and so forth, that it's not characterized by, you know, strict observances of regulative principles, but it's spontaneous, that it's motivated by you know, by one's own actual taste and attraction, and therefore, you know, one should not glorify too much the strict practices and sincere, like you're talking about today, strict sadhana and lines in stone, but really that only takes you up to a certain point, and then your natural emotions for actually serving Krishna should take over or something like that. It's always kind of rubs me the wrong way when I hear devotees talking like that, because I think that they're not, you know, they're really inviting themselves to give up their strict practices. But I wanted your kind of comment on that.
Well, Raghunath Das Goswami is our Prayojana Acharya, and his practice was like lines in stone. So we can take help from that, and also Srinivas Acharya talked about the six Goswamis of Vrindavan, Sankhya Purvaka Nama Gana Natibi. Very clearly he talks about how they counted everything. They're very strict about counting how many rounds they did and so forth. And there's a paradox in that. Because of the nature of the internal potency of the Lord, that strictness keeps one close to that internal potency as one practices. And there's a natural spontaneity, obviously, it can't be legislated. Otherwise, how is it spontaneous? But it grows naturally from the sincere heart of a person who's joyfully practicing devotional service. And that comes as one rises above the material modes of material nature. Mamcha yovyabhicharena bhakti yogena sevate sagunan samatityaitan brahma bhuyaya kalpate. One who engages in devotional service in all circumstances. How are you going to do that without being strict? Otherwise, the mind will intervene and take you somewhere else. If you give it an inch, it will take a mile. Sorry for the cliche. But one who rises above the material nature, he's free. He's free to act spontaneously in devotional service and is no longer under the dictates of the three modes of material nature. Yeah.
I just had another comment about lines in stone because I like it so much. And there's even an English expression that, you know, something is etched in stone, you know, like when you're trying to get a date for a meeting or something like that, and people say, well, it's, you know, we can pencil it in, but later let's get it etched in stone or let's get it in concrete or something like that. But I was thinking that lines in stone, you know, it has two meanings. One is that, you know, once it's down in stone, you can't change it, like you can't erase it and put it somewhere else. It's been etched in stone. But another meaning is that if you do something on stone over and over again, even though it's imperceptible, like if you take a piece of stone and you rub it every day just along one particular direction, that after some time there'll be an indentation and you can actually wear a groove in it. And that, you know, by actually regular practice, one can become, one can develop a very, very strong habit that way.
Nice. Actually, one's sincere devotional service attracts the attention of Krishna, who extends himself to the devotee in such a way that one's devotional service becomes more spontaneous. So it's not that we can force the issue. It's we follow the process of devotional service, and Krishna extends himself as he wishes. It's up to him. Nayamatma prabhachanena labhyo namedaya nabahuna shutena yami vaisha vrinute tena labhyas tashyaisha esha vrinute tena labhya tanum swam. Krishna shows himself to those whom he chooses. It's not a matter of some rote or formula or something like that. But at the same time, one who's sincerely practicing and following the spiritual master, there's a way in which that attracts Krishna's attention. And he helps the devotee to advance in devotional service. So we're going to move on. Yes, one last comment.
So I had a comment here. Strict and sincereness. If you're practicing something that way, you have pure goals there, right? Maybe as part of that, it could be perceived by someone because you have set goals and set, you know, sincerity, that it could be perceived that you are hard-hearted. So is it just a perception difference, or you know what I mean? Like, is there a difference in perception?
What do you mean by hard-hearted?
If my kid wants something and he's persistent about getting something, but I say, nope, you know, sweets are not allowed in the night. You know, I have sincere and, you know, strict rules that these are the things and guidelines which will make you know, your sort of life shape up, you know, different manner or whatever. But it's perceived by the kid.
So he thinks you're hard-hearted.
Yeah. So that's what I'm trying to, you know, is that what the question was, or it was a different question? You know what I mean?
Well, was that the question? The question was, if you practice strictly, does it mean that you'll become hard-hearted? Well, in any kind of practice regarding this question, one has to remember the purpose. There is a way that one can become absorbed in rote practice. That is, performing the rules and regulations only for the sake of performing them, not for the sake of advancing in devotional service. And one might define that as a hard-heartedness or closed-mindedness, and not actually appreciating the purpose behind following the rules and regulations. As far as the student and the master, if the master is giving some kind of dictate that do it like this, don't do it like that, if the student is not a willing participant, then there may be a way in which he or she will resent the teacher and think, you know, you're just trying to dominate me or something like that. And therefore, for a father-son relationship or a father and, you know, child relationship, sometimes it's a little more difficult because the child didn't volunteer. For disciple, the idea is that someone's like, I want to reform myself, therefore I'm approaching you. You please correct me. And therefore, it's a slightly different relationship. So there's a thankless aspect of being a guardian sometimes, that one may be perceived as hard-hearted, but oftentimes you'll find that people later on, when they benefit from those disciplines that were offered to them, which were imposed upon them even, will thank their guardian later and say, if it hadn't been for the strictness of my father or mother, that I would have been lost. In fact, Prabhupada tells a story about a child who was sentenced to death for murder, and then just before he died, he called his uncle or whoever was his guardian to the cell and said, please come close, I want to whisper something to you in your ear. And then he bit his ear off and said, if you had been more strict with me, I wouldn't have been a murderer. I have more material to cover and not much time. Can I move forward? Occur enough, last point.
I apologize because it may be a big one, but
I'm sure it's
the question is about like fault finding, that when we're trying to be strict with ourselves and follow some strict discipline with ourselves, and then we see other people are not being as strict, especially if they're members of the same organization or community, sometimes we resent that and we try to demand that I've seen this a lot, that we try to demand that other people practice the strictness, maybe because it's attractive to us that we want to be lax or something. We see other people are lax and we start getting on their case, even though they're not like really our...
Got it. State the question.
And speaking of hard-heartedness, I mean, isn't that part of it? How can we overcome that?
Well, first of all, I mean, Prabhupada says one's eyes should be trained to spot offenses. So one should train one's eyes to spot offenses in oneself and rectify them. And also one should know one's position, one's relationship with others. First of all, very rarely does one reform others simply by open letters on the internet and things like that. People aren't reformed by that. People are generally most impressed by seeing a personal example because it's irreproachable. If someone has an impeccable character and shows by example, it's very hard to say anything about that person. One example comes to my mind, a way in which Jayadvaita Swami publishes his expense account on the internet regularly, down to the penny. And he's a very meticulous kind of person. I notice how he'll just account for everything. Here's how many donations I received. Here's what I spent. Here's what I had left over. This is my life. At the end, these are true statements. And then there's not much you can say. You know, he's open, clear, and sets by example, then the whole discussion about should a sannyasi have money, this and that, it becomes, clarified in that. So that's one point. And the other point is that we have a relationship with various kinds of people, and we should know what that relationship is. If someone hasn't come to you and said, please correct me, then you don't have to take that burden on your head to try to correct them. Just try to correct yourself and those who are interested in hearing from you. This is one of the austerities of speech Prabhupada mentions in the purport in the 17th chapter of the Gita, that unless somebody has declared themselves your student, or by proximity, coming into a certain circumstances has implied that, then it's not your duty to correct their every move. And it may not be effective in your doing so. So, you know, the old adage, just, I don't know, what is the old adage? Be the example. Be the change that you want to see in other people. And then if you do have to say something, you can back it up. Otherwise, it's practically useless. I remember 5 or 6 years ago at the Temple President's meeting, there was someone who was a strong advocate that everyone should be giving 50% of his income. He was writing papers about it. He was talking about it in an animated way. And then someone finally asked him, do you do that? And he said, well, no, but I don't do that. But I think that, you know, when I retire, that, you know, I'll leave in my will 50% of my income. And then everyone just sort of, no one said anything, but everyone kind of looked around like, well, there went the strength of his, you know, argument. So just do it yourself. Where on the other hand, if he had published his financials and said 50% is going to the such and such temple or whatever, he wouldn't have had to say anything at all. Right? Or if he did say something, it would have been really potent. So, there's a lot. It is a big topic, and it's important. I want to say a few more things about practice. So, introspection is important in practice. Otherwise, practice can become routine. And we don't want routine practice. We want introspective, vital practice. So, one thing is to remember that Krishna is watching. And that Krishna is fulfilling all our desires also. And what do you want? That's an introspective question. What do you want? And whoever stops to actually ask themselves that question and answer it clearly, well, the answer is the person who's very progressive in life does that. But if you stop anyone on the street and say, what do you really want? A myriad of images might come into their mind and impressions randomly, things that they've been thinking about. But to pinpoint their actual goal in life or things that will be really good for them, they may have not clearly thought about it. So in our practice, understanding that Krishna is a touchstone, and as we just read in the Brahma Samhita, Brahma was given a mantra. And Saraswati said, this mantra will fulfill all your desires. So how about that? How about that? This mantra will fulfill all your desires. Everyone said, oh, my desires are unfulfilled. I want some. I never get what I want. And someone finally says, okay, quiet down for a minute. I'm going to give you something that's going to fulfill all your desires. Take this. It'll fulfill all your desires. Now the problem is, what do you want? So if you sit down under the desire tree and you're not clear about what you want, you might get some unclear result. If you're clear about what you want, but it's not good for you, and you say, you know, I would like a bag of hammers to fall on my head. And then the bag of hammers falls from the tree and it hits you on the head. And then who are you going to blame? Who are you going to blame? Not the tree. So Krishna is fulfilling everyone's desires since the time immemorial. And as we come to Krishna consciousness, we understand very specifically that these are live mantras. They're fulfilling our desires exactly as they appear. So clarify what it is you want. And even if the random desires that are coming into your mental system are not good for you, pinpoint those things that are good for you. This means spiritual intelligence, which Krishna advocates at the end of the third chapter and elsewhere of the Bhagavad Gita, in which he says that you should overcome the lower self by the higher self. Use your intelligence to move ahead. Buddhi yoga, find out what's really good for you, and then cultivate that desire. So introspection means cultivation of desire, and that's exciting. You can be a gardener. You can decide what goes in your garden rather than letting just any seed blow in there and grow. Decide what you want to grow. Get rid of the things that you don't want. You can do that. That's your prerogative as a human being, given some freedom in this lifetime as a soul. That's the freedom you have to cultivate your garden the way you want it to be. So be introspective and understand that you have such power to improve yourself through selective gardening. pull out the weeds. Only plant the seeds that you want to see grow. Even if you don't have full faith that they will grow, take the word of the great devotees in the Shastra and plant them anyway and start to water them, and then you'll be amazed. So intention must be strong, and this can be a product of this introspection, of deciding what it is you want. So when alternatives come up, you say, no, I've already decided. This is your intention is already there. So Maya will present you with myriad alternatives to this desire that you have to advance in devotional service. How about this? How about that? And she's really good at it because she can present things that look like they have verisimilitude. They look just like what you thought you wanted, but a little bit different. And you might be tricked by that unless your intention is very strong, unless you've pinpointed what is the actual seed. You've studied the science. What does the Bhakti Lata Beach look like? And what does the Karma Beach look like? What does the Jnana Beach look like? Because if you don't study it carefully, you'll be fooled. And Maya fools those who want to be fooled. And this is where sincerity comes into play. If there's something in my heart where I actually want to be fooled, I don't want to wake up yet, Maya would be expert and say, here it is. Here's your nice little package that's custom made for you according to your material desires. And then unless you've been very specific in deciding that you're going to take Krishna's instruction rather than Maya's random presentations or custom-made presentations, I should say, then you'll be dissuaded. You'll be deviated from the path of strict, serious, sincere practice. So there are two rules in the practice of devotional service, which Rupa Goswami very liberally begins with in his presentation of Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu, is that one must always remember Krishna and never forget Krishna. Within that framework, one has a lot of liberty to organize one's personal practice so that you can do those two things. But you have to do these two things. You have to always remember Krishna and never forget Krishna. And he doesn't say specifically everyone has to do it like this. He gives so many different varieties of activity that may give people in various modes of nature, in various positions in life, an opportunity to do that. So always remember Krishna, never forget Krishna. We call the four regulative principles the regulative principles of freedom. These are a framework to work with. Cultivate these four regulative principles of freedom. The more you're able to practice these four regulations, no illicit sex, and think about what that means in all its subtleties, and practice it very carefully. No intoxication. Think about what that means in all its subtleties. No gambling and no meat eating. There's a lot that can be said about the subtleties of these things, but just taking these bare four regulative principles, they free one from the obligation to Maya. And make your stand here. The four regulative principles are a great framework of mercy given to us by our acharya so that we can protect ourselves from the onslaught of Maya. And then 16 rounds. So this prescription, four regulative principles and 16 rounds. This is a basis of our practice. These are fundamentals. Just by strictly doing these, 4 and 16 every day, one can become as strong as the Himalaya mountains in one's practice. Prabhupada told that to one sannyasi. If you follow very strictly the four regular principles and chant very carefully your 16 rounds every day, your practice of devotional service will become as strong as the Himalaya mountains. Yes.
Hare Krishna, I just had this thought when you mentioned about the four regulative principles of freedom, and previously that you were saying how Maya is always attacking. So I just felt that, you know, a soldier goes into a battle, he wears his armor. If you don't have the armor, he's going to get attacked. And the enemy is always looking when he's dropping the guard. So four regulative principles essentially is an armor or a guard. You drop even one and there you are. You're opening yourself to getting injured. So thank you.
Very well put. Yes, like armor. Now, to help us in customizing and prioritizing our practice, Rupa Goswami gives 64 items of devotional service. Actually, there are many more than that. But he gives 64 items, very specifically in the Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu, but mentions that in the Hari Bhakti Vilas, there are more than that mentioned. But these are primary 64. But then to make it even more focused, then he gives five. And may I have the Madhya Lila 22.128, please? Govindacharan's got it. So in the Chaitanya Charitamrita, we'll find Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu and his teachings to Sanatan Goswami in helping us refine our practice of the 64 items of devotional service. Tells us about five, which are the most potent of the 64. Amazingly potent, so much so that you'll hear something that will make your ears tingle and your feet want to dance. Do you want to hear something that makes your ears tingle and your feet want to dance?
Yeah.
Okay, here it is. Thank you, Govindacharan Prabhu. That's 22.128. Perfect. Okay, thank you very much. So, here's a shloka, and I'll read a few, and I'll tell you when I'm going to get to the one that I felt will make your ears tingle and your feet want to dance. On 128, Sadhu Sangha Nam Kirtan Bhagavat Shravan Mathura Vas Sri Murtira Shradhaya Sevana. So these are five. One should associate with devotees, chant the holy name of the Lord, hear Srimad Bhagavatam, reside at Mathura, and worship the deity with faith and veneration. These five limbs of devotional service are the best of all. Even a slight performance of these five awakens love for Krishna. With love and full faith, one should worship the lotus feet of the deity. One should taste the meaning of Srimad Bhagavatam in the association of pure devotees, and one should associate with the devotees who are more advanced than oneself and who are endowed with a similar type of affection for the Lord. One should congregationally chant the holy name of the Lord and reside in Vrindavan. Here it is. Are you ready?
Yes.
Brace yourselves. The power of these five is very wonderful and difficult to understand. Even without faith in them, a person who is offenseless can awaken his dormant love of Krishna simply by being a little connected with them. Even without faith. A little connection. They're so powerful, it's difficult to understand how powerful they are. That's Krishna's mercy. Keep this in mind when your mind tells you that it's too difficult to attain higher stages of devotion or to advance in devotional service. It's meant for others, not for me. How can I do this? My circumstances are so convoluted. There's so many combinations and permutations. No one can understand my situation. It's so problematic. Keep this in mind. I'll read it one more time. The power of these five principles is very wonderful and difficult to understand. Even without faith in them, a person who is offenseless can awaken his dormant love of Krishna simply by being a little connected with them. Akurnath Prabhu.
There are so many devotees who are very dedicated and faithful devotees and still have trouble giving up offenses. How can we understand that a faithless person can be offenseless?
It's connected to sincerity. Don't be resentful of the fact that you're not making the kind of advancement that you thought you'd make. Because there's a lot of different reasons why you may not make the kind of advancement you thought you'd make. But don't resent it. It's a state of heart, non-resentfulness, which is kind of an offenselessness, which is that feeling that Krishna is in charge of this. Krishna is in charge of this. It is a little paradoxical because that requires faith. You say you don't have faith. But Krishna mentions in the 13th chapter of the Bhagavad Gita, a person who is open and innocent, even though ignorant, can come to the highest stage and understand Paramatma simply by hearing from others. So there's a certain quality there. Very particularly in all kinds of endeavors and practice of devotional service, especially, one should beware of resentfulness, bitterness, insincerity. And because those taint one's service, they are not attractive to other devotees, and they're also not attractive to Krishna. I'll think about it more. So far, are your ears tingling?
Yes.
Do you feel like dancing?
Yes.
Okay, why? Can you say? What did you like about this statement of Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, who's teaching Sanatana Goswami? Anything particularly that caught your interest?
That even a slight faith and a little performance, those
even
seem to
no
be,
faith and slight performance.
Yeah, no faith and slight performance. So
you like
that gives that more confidence.
Yeah, so the mind generally, there's a way in which the mind will be all or nothing. That if I can't make it all, I won't do anything. But remember, a slight connection. Sudeep?
What I really liked it, it was difficult to understand. That gave me a lot of solace because I'm really not understanding this, and it's clearly stated, it's difficult to understand. Don't bother about understanding. Just keep following. So that gives me a lot of solace.
That's good. Solace is good. You need solace to continue your practice. Solace in your practice. Karna.
It's exciting because it makes it seem like it's possible. Even in the Nectar of Devotion, I think there's a statement that these five practices, even a neophyte can get a taste of real ecstasy by practicing these.
There it is. Yes. And a text has come in. And those of you who are online, we thank you for joining the class. 650-255-2227 is the number to text in. We have operators standing by to take your calls.
This is Jim Prabhu from San Diego.
Hare Krishna, Bhakti Jim.
And he says that, Hare Krishna Gurudev, I'm so glad to hear about the five things. I don't think I can keep track of 64. But knowing I don't even need faith to awaken Krishna's love, I'm glad all I need is sincerity. Hare Krishna.
Sounds like a very faithful devotee. Okay, so moving on. Chaitanya Mahaprabhu says, when one is firmly fixed in devotional service, whether he executes one or many processes of devotional service, the waves of love of Godhead will awaken. There are waves waiting to wash in. There are many devotees who execute only one of the nine processes of devotional service. Nonetheless, they get ultimate success. Devotees like Maharaj Ambarish execute all nine items, and they also get ultimate success. So I wanted to bring that to your attention, that out of this sense of anugraha, wanting us to follow, the acharyas have given us options, 64, now 5, a way to fix your mind, and then these statements that if you're slightly connected with them, so don't be overly concerned at one particular part of your life that you can't be fully absorbed. Be slightly connected and always stay alive, in always remembering Krishna and never forgetting him by being slightly connected at least. Now, there are aspects of practice which are important, elements of practice which can be very helpful. And first of all, just about the theory of practice in general, I'd like to read something, enter into evidence here today, something that seems so obvious, but when you hear it it will inspire your practice. Would you like to hear that?
Yes.
I'd like to hear it again. I just wrote it down, but this is the law of practice. The logarithm of the reaction time for a particular task decreases linearly with the logarithm of the number of practice trials taken. To summarize, practice improves performance. I'll say it again. The logarithm of the reaction time for a particular task decreases linearly with the logarithm of the number of practice trials taken. You like that?
Yes.
I like it too much. This is for the mind. It's medicine for the mind. To remember your daily practice. Practice works. Practice works. And as you practice, your performance will improve, period. That's just the way things work. So practice a lot, or as much as you possibly can, because in discipline, there are such great rewards. We can't even measure them because they're synergistic. They enter into different elements, and that they become more productive than we can even imagine. A little bit of sincere practice comes out the other side in an exponentially expanded way. So, but remember this, that if you practice, you'll get better. If you practice, you'll get better. And a few other elements of practice in general. It's dependent on your choice, which is a nice way to express yourself, your freedom. You get to make a choice. What is the choice? Do you want to do those things that are life-enhancing or reactive? You have a choice to do things that are life-enhancing or reactive. You can choose what you practice, and then you don't simply have to react to the things that happen to you. And whatever you focus on increases in your life. Second of principles of practice is that you should have a strong purpose. And this is very important, and you'll see throughout Prabhupada's purports, especially if you do a Veda-based search for Vishnu Chakravarti Thakur, you'll notice that dozens of times Prabhupada quotes Vishnu Chakravarti Thakur in relationship to his commentary on the Bhagavad Gita verse Vyavasayatmika Budhir. Ekeha Kuru Nandana, which means that one should steadfastly and one-pointedly focus on serving the Lord. And Vishnu Chakravarti Thakur, in his commentary on this verse, has talked about taking the order of the spiritual master, and a specific order of the spiritual master. Some time ago, Pri Kishori gave me a placard that she made by hand, and I have up on my wall. It's from a letter Srila Prabhupada wrote to one of his disciples, telling this disciple not to deviate his mind even for an instant from the service of distributing books, to increasing the book distribution. Very specific instruction. Don't deviate your mind even for an instant from this service. If you can attach yourself to such an authorized instruction, a very specific instruction, there are many general instructions, but if you can get for yourself a very specific instruction, you may think, oh, that's very restrictive. No, it's not. It's actually, it frees you from obligations to all other kinds of things. Things meaning dictates of the mind, or even other service opportunities which may bewilder your mind as well. And you may specialize in this. And then from that, your practice will expand. So get your purpose clear. And for devotees, very important to have a very specific instruction to follow, a very specific service, because your seva will save you. Beware of interference in your practice. As you practice, as you plant a garden, that weeds will come, I guarantee you. It always happens. When you start a business and you're successful, predatory marketers will come and set up shop right next to yours. I guarantee it, it always happens, it always will. It's the way the material world works. Don't think otherwise. Be ready for interference in your practice of devotional service. Doubts will come. Fears will hold you back. But here's a mantra. Do what you fear and watch it disappear. Approach those things with boldness and take them on, and you'll see that they disappear by the power of practice. Everything that you're doing now leaves a footprint. There's a legacy from your methodical practice in life. Try to always leave things better than you found them. And remember the power of synergy, as I mentioned before. Every discipline affects every other discipline in your life. Don't think I only let down in this area. It doesn't count. It counts. There's synergy. And every discipline that you take up, every practice that you take up, will affect the other actions and aspects of your life. The law of consistency in practice, very nice word, very specific word, consistency. Small, consistent acts build great things. Simple sutra. Small, consistent acts. You may think it's insignificant, but if it's consistent, it will amount to something really great. Presence in practice. Remember, the now is the only time you have, because your mind will deviate from the practice and say, well, what about yesterday? What about tomorrow? Forget it. Practice being in the present moment. Commitment, another specific word. Make a pact with your purpose. You've defined your purpose. Make a specific pact that I'm going to stick with my purpose no matter what. Be detached. Detachment is very powerful. It helps you to be objective. Be innocent. That is, start every day fresh with new eyes. Look at your practice as you're doing it for the first time. And be responsible means another sutra. If it's to be, it's up to me. Don't depend on somebody else. Don't blame someone else if you're unable to practice properly. Say, if it's to be, it's up to me. And then finally, be grateful. Be grateful for whatever you get, because when you're grateful, it opens the possibilities for more blessings to flow into your life. So those help with one of the first aspects of practice, which is that it should be done with a proper attitude. And Prabhupada mentions in the Nectar of Instruction that advancement in Krishna consciousness depends on the attitude of the follower. What do you think about that? Yes, Lavanya.
Hare Krishna Guru Maharaj. Maharaj, before you go any further, what you just finished,
yes,
you said detachment, and at the same time you said, if it's to be, it depends on me.
Yeah.
And they contradict each other. Could you explain that?
Well, it's paradoxical in a sense, but 50% comes from Krishna, 50% comes from me, as indicated in the story of the Damodar Leela, when Yashoda Mata chases after Krishna and tries to tie him up with rope, and it's 2 inches too short, 2 inches too short, 2 inches too short, 2 inches too short, and then she starts to perspire, and then Krishna sees she's trying so hard. Let her tie me up, you know. So he agrees to be tied up. And our Acharya Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur has commented that this indicates that 50% comes from our personal labor and 50% comes from Krishna's mercy. 1 inch indicates our endeavor. 1 inch indicates Krishna is extending himself to us. So we can think like that, that if it's to be, it's up to me. But at the same time, we understand that my ability to do this, my ability to be determined, everything, I'm grateful for it because it's coming from Krishna.
Sometimes, like a regular day, like a day at the temple, when you want to attend a lecture, if I'm to be there, I have to work harder to get there. And then along the way, you will have 4 or 6 cutoffs before you get to the car. And hopefully the car gets you to the temple. So, you know, along the way, I sometimes wonder, how far should I push myself and say, these obstacles are just to train me to get to the temple? And what is the day when I say, okay, maybe it's not today. I'm going to listen online. I said it because it's a practical example of what we do every time.
Well, I've noticed about cutoffs is that they can be eliminated over time. That's one thing about practice. Find out where the cutoffs are and then plan to cut them off. I just noticed that, when you have a very tight schedule, when we were in Govardhan recently, we had a tight schedule. Every 5 minutes counts. And I would really notice that there were certain things. Like I have a little sign that says, please do not disturb. And if I hang it on my door, at the ashram, it would eliminate some cutoffs, which would, someone knock on the door and say, can I talk to you about such and such? And then, one thing could lead to another. But I was very clear about my boundaries and say, I'm not available right now for anything, for any reason. Then that would eliminate 99.9% of the time cutoffs, just as an example. And there's a route from when I was in Vrindavan from the MVT where I was staying to the temple. And knowing that I had to complete certain vows, I would take the back route. Because I knew if I took the other route, I would be stopped, five, six times. Hey, Maish, how you doing? Where are you living now anyway? You still, How about that? Are you in San Jose? What is it? Mountain View. And after six times of that and, an hour and a half goes by, then I'd miss the thing. So, there's a cutoff over that way. So I'd go the back way and I'd go down the alleyway. So if you're locked in to a purpose and you're looking for numerical strength, eliminate the cutoffs as much as possible. And then it becomes a game of efficiency to do that. So another point is inspirational sadhana. May I have the Bhagavatam 1.6.15, please? This is an advocacy of non-mechanical devotional service and a very interesting pastime for our edification in the Srimad Bhagavatam regarding Narada Muni, one of our great acharyas, who's the Bhakti Acharya. He's a Shaktivesh avatar. What is his avesh? It's Bhakti Shakti. Thank you, Govindacharan Guru. Narada Muni. After that, under the shadow of a banyan tree in an uninhabited forest, I began to meditate upon the supersoul situated within using my intelligence as I had learned from liberated souls. Purport. One should not meditate according to one's personal whims. One should know perfectly well from the authoritative sources of scriptures through the transparent medium of a bona fide spiritual master and by proper use of one's trained intelligence for meditating upon the supersoul dwelling within every living being. This consciousness is firmly developed by a devotee who has rendered loving service unto the Lord by carrying out the orders of the spiritual master. Sri Naradaji contacted bona fide spiritual masters, served them sincerely, and got enlightenment rightly. Thus he began to meditate. 16. As soon as I began to meditate upon the lotus feet of the personality of Godhead, with my mind transformed in transcendental love, tears rolled down my eyes, and without delay, the personality of Godhead, Sri Krishna, appeared on the lotus of my heart. Purport, the word bhava is significant here. This bhava stage is attained after one has transcended, as one has transcendental affection for the Lord. The first initial stage is called shraddha, or a liking for the Supreme Lord. And in order to increase that liking, one has to associate with pure devotees of the Lord. The third stage is to practice the prescribed rules and regulations of devotional service. This will dissipate all sorts of misgivings and remove all personal deficiencies that hamper progress in devotional service. When all misgivings and personal deficiencies are removed, there is a standard faith in transcendental matter. Isn't that nice? And the taste for it increases in greater proportion. This stage leads to attraction, and after this, there is bhava, or the prior stage of unalloyed love for God. All the above different stages are but different stages of development of transcendental love. Being so surcharged with transcendental love, there becomes a strong feeling of separation, which leads to 8 different kinds of ecstasies. Tears from the eyes of a devotee is an automatic reaction. And because Sri Narada, in his previous birth, attained that stage very quickly after his departure from home, it was quite possible for him to perceive the actual presence of the Lord, which he tangibly experienced by his developed spiritual senses without material tinge. Get ready. Things are about to change. O Vyasadeva, at that time, being exceedingly overpowered by feelings of happiness, every part of my body became separately enlivened. Being absorbed in an ocean of ecstasy, I could not see both myself and the Lord. Purport. Spiritual feelings of happiness and intense ecstasies. Is everyone with me?
Yes.
Have no mundane comparison. Therefore, it is very difficult to give expression to such feelings. We can just have a glimpse of such ecstasy in the words of Sri Narada Muni. Each and every part of the body or senses has this particular function. After seeing the Lord, all the senses become fully awakened to render service unto the Lord, because in the liberated state, the senses are fully efficient in serving the Lord. As such, in the transcendental ecstasy, it so happened that the senses became separately enlivened to serve the Lord. This being so, Narada Muni lost himself in seeing both himself and the Lord simultaneously. Text 18, the transcendental form of the Lord as it is satisfies the mind's desires at once, and at once erases all mental incongruities. Upon losing that form, I suddenly got up, being perturbed, as is usual when one loses that which is desirable. 19. I desired to see again that transcendental form of the Lord. But despite my attempts to concentrate upon the heart with eagerness to view the form again, I could not see him anymore. And thus dissatisfied, I was very much aggrieved. Purport. There is no mechanical process to see the form of the Lord. It completely depends on the causeless mercy of the Lord. We cannot demand the Lord to be present before a vision, just as we cannot demand the sun to rise whenever we like. The sun rises out of his own accord, so also the Lord is pleased to be present out of his causeless mercy. One should simply await the opportune moment and go on discharging his prescribed duty in devotional service to the Lord. Narada Muni thought that the Lord could be seen again by the same mechanical process which was successful in the first attempt. But in spite of his utmost endeavor, he could not make the second attempt successful. The Lord is completely independent of all obligations. He can simply be bound up by the tie of unalloyed devotion, nor is he visible or perceivable by our material senses. When he pleases, being satisfied with the sincere attempt of devotional service depending completely on the mercy of the Lord, then he may be seen out of his own sweet accord. This is a clue to our practice. Although we're talking about numerical strength, although we're talking about substantial devotional service, this is a sign of seriousness and so forth, we must always remember that the Lord appears of his own sweet accord. Now, in this story of Narada Muni, we notice that Krishna appeared to him, and he felt complete ecstasy beyond the imagination. And naturally, the symptoms of love of God appeared in him, all the symptoms. Then Krishna disappeared. And the second time, Narada thought, I'll get him back. And he began to practice mechanically, and the Lord didn't appear. Seeing my attempts in that lonely place, the personality of Godhead, who is transcendental to all material descriptions, spoke to me with gravity and pleasing words just to mitigate my grief. O Narada, the Lord spoke, I regret that during this lifetime you will not be able to see me anymore. Those who are incomplete in service and who are not completely free from all material taints can hardly see me. O virtuous one, you have already once seen my person, and this is just to increase your desire for me. Because the more you hanker for me, the more you will be freed from all material desire. By service of the Absolute Truth, even for a few days, a devotee attains firm and fixed intelligence in me. Consequently, he goes on to become my associate in the transcendental world after giving up the present deplorable material worlds. Intelligence engaged in my devotion cannot be thwarted at any time. Even at the time of creation, as well as the time of annihilation, your remembrance will continue by my mercy. Then that supreme authority, personified by sound and unseen by eyes, but most wonderful, stopped speaking. Feeling a sense of gratitude, I offered my obeisances unto him, bowing my head. Thus I began chanting the holy name and fame of the Lord by repeated recitation, ignoring all the formalities of the material world. Such chanting and remembering of the transcendental pastimes of the Lord are benedictory. So doing, I traveled all over the earth, fully satisfied, humble, and unenvious. This is a very instructive story because in one's case, he sat down and meditated. He wasn't expecting anything, especially. And it was non-mechanical. And the Lord appeared to him. And then he disappeared. For the benefit of Narada, to increase his desire, he disappeared. And then Narada tried again. Again, he tried mechanically and thought, oh, I can bring the Lord back by this mechanical process. And Krishna didn't appear. This is the great mystery of practice. Although in one sense we're practicing because we know we need to be strict, serious, and sincere in order to advance in devotional service, at the same time the attitude must be whatever comes is the mercy of the Lord. Anashlishava paravatam pinashnumam adarshanam marma hatam karotuva. You may appear to me or not appear to me, I'm still going to go on with my practice. And there is solace and even ecstasy in that feeling. That although the Lord is not appearing before me, although I'm not getting a taste, you know, that is overwhelming, still I'll go on with my service. And in the instant one feels like this and has that determination that even if the Lord doesn't appear to me, even if he doesn't give me any taste, I'm continuing anyway. There's taste in that. That's something very tasty, actually, that I don't care if he doesn't give me anything, I'm still going to practice. That's the essence. Ashlishiva pararatam pinashnam adarshanam. He doesn't give me darshan. I'm still going to go on worshiping him unconditionally. So, yes.
Guru Maharaj, doesn't the vision of the Lord purify you, as in Nala Kuvera's case? The moment they saw the Lord, they were purified, and they chose to become pure devotees because the very fact...
Yeah, well, you'll notice that Narada is purified also. He now, although the Lord doesn't reveal himself, he said, you won't be able to see me again in this life. What does he do now? He's grateful. He mentions he's very grateful. He's had, you know, this contact with the Lord. And he also feels contact and separation. That's why he goes on traveling and chanting without, as he says, considering the formalities of the material world.
So seeing the Lord is not an end in itself.
Well,
I don't understand why Narada had to go on.
Narada
had to go on after seeing the Lord. And I thought that when you see the Lord, you become a pure
because devotee. He wasn't completely perfect. There are different stages of perfection. And there's a way in which one... makes progress even after having such an encounter. And, Ajamil, although he had darshan of the Vishnudutas, and he heard everything they said, after they disappeared, and he tried to approach them, then they disappeared, he understood that now he needed more practice. He went to Prayag, and he continued his devotional service until he was 100% perfect.
I was reading about Mother Earth when Parikshit Maharaj had punishment and reward of Kali when he found the personality of Kali torturing the bull and the cow. She said that, well, I became proud because you were always walking on my surface and the hairs of my body, the grass was standing up like the hairs of my body. But then the Lord left me and made me feel bereft. And I thought that this is a recurring theme. The Lord left the rasa dance. But my question is this, that usually when we hear this verse in the second chapter of Bhagavad Gita 47, Mapaleshu Kadacha, you know, you have a right to perform your duty, but you don't have a right to the fruits. And usually we're thinking in terms of, because it's getting rid of fruitive activity because you're material, you want material fruits, I want riches, I want this and that. But you just have to do your duty. And but does it have an application as well to, you know, the fruit being making advancement or getting Krishna's darshan? And
well, the fact is, just in general, that the devotee is never separated from Krishna. Although it may say the devotee is separated from Krishna, there's more connection in separation than there is in meeting Krishna. Paradoxically. And there's a way in which, for instance, the residents of Vrindavan who were separated from Krishna, as he left them, apparently. He gets on the chariot with Akrur and he goes away to Vrindavan and so forth. In fact, described in the Shastra that in Goloka, that pastime occurs over and over and over and over and over again. That they, it's new every time. It's not that they... Every time Akura comes, every time they try to stop his chariot, and every time they feel the intense burning of separation, which is described by the Acharyas as the fire of pralaya, or destruction at the end of the universe, is the hottest fire there is. If you multiply that billions of times, that's the fire of separation that is felt by the devotees when they're separated from Krishna. And it's not advertised that much in the Srimad Bhagavatam or other devotional literatures because, according to our acharyas, it will scare away the general public from taking the devotional service because they don't understand that within that separation is the highest form of ecstasy. And this was introduced by Madhavendra Puri and Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. Chaitanya Mahaprabhu taught it and his disciples codified it, brought it into, you know, our sampradaya is based on this principle of union through separation, which is inconceivable. But the devotee is never separated from Krishna. And yes, there's a way in which this form of gratitude the devotees feel that if Krishna gives them some connection, some feeling of ecstasy in their practice, they take it as Krishna's special mercy. But they don't demand or expect it. Well, they can expect it. The devotee, tate anukampam susamikshamano, is always expecting the mercy of the Lord because, after all, the Lord is the bhaktavatsal. And that's his preoccupation, is rewarding the devotees. So they're always expecting that mercy. But they don't demand it. They take any glimmer of attention that they apparently get from the Lord as being his causeless mercy. And in that, you know, even an iota of connection with the Lord, it becomes expanded. Pratibha.
On this one verse was coming to my mind, even when I took the kids there, is that a devotee who bears the burnt or burden of his karmas and still continues his faith becomes a rightful candidate to the entry into the kingdom of God. I don't know exact words, but this is the gist. So this was coming to my mind when I was listening to this. Oh, you just said that.
Well, I said the first part of it, and then you said the second part, which is that this is very important in understanding the attitude of a devotee in his practice. This verse comes from Lord Brahma, who spoke it to Krishna after the Brahma Vimohana Lila, and he said that the devotee is always expecting the causeless mercy of the Lord, and he goes on suffering the results of his past misdeeds, considering that it's his own fault. He's created the reaction himself. And in that tolerance of everything that's going on to whatever reactions are coming to him, is the inherent right of going back to Godhead. Sadaya Bhak means an inheritor, so he inherits the kingdom of God.
I find this very, very comforting. Like whenever hard times come, I always tell myself that, I remind myself of this verse, so that's very comforting.
It is, because devotees see whatever kinds of karma are coming to them, apparent karma, actually, in the purport. There's an explanation by Sridhar Swami, the great Bhagavatam Acharya, great Vaishnava Acharya, who commented on the Bhagavatam extensively, that actually devotees don't have karma, but they have specific reciprocation from Krishna, that he gives them miseries which are custom-made so that they'll give up the last vestiges of attachment. And Krishna knows very well what those are. And therefore, he brings very specific kinds of apparent karmic reactions, which are his special mercy, so the devotee will finally give up even the last vestiges of attachment to the material world. So Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur and other acharyas explain that these kinds of miseries are not a burden to the devotee, or they are a burden, but they're the kind of burden that a businessman feels when he's given great wealth to manage. yes, it may be a burden of management, but it's very nice. And the devotee also understands that this is my last vestiges of karma being burned up. It means I'm getting closer to going back home, back to Godhead, and being with Krishna. So there's no lamentation in that. So, another text?
It came some time back when we were talking about practice and performance. So this is from Saudi Arabia, Rajesh Prabhu.
Jai Rajesh.
And he says, Hari Bol, Hare Krishna Gurudev, about practice. Practice makes a man perfect. And then he writes, Bhajante Mam Dridha Vrata. So
that's Yeah, that's such a nice statement. Practice makes perfect. And even more precisely, perfect practice makes perfect. My Madanga teacher points this out to me all the time, that if you go slow, and if you do it slow and correctly, then later on you can go fast and correct. Tendency is, as soon as you start a new beat, and then speed up, speed up, speed up, and it's slightly off, but at least I'm doing it. And he said, no, you're not doing it correctly. Go slow, like a complete beginner, very slow, and get it completely right. And then later on, you can go fast and completely right. But you can't do it if you don't practice perfectly. Of course, there's a way in which in devotional service, our perfect practice is sincere practice. And Krishna makes up for many of our mistakes and so forth. And there's a way in which by making mistakes, we learn. They become the pillars of success. So this is a vast topic, which we'll end for today now, with just a summary that look no further than discipline and practice for happiness in life, especially devotional practice and discipline. Don't blame anyone else. Just take shelter of your practice. And whatever stage you're at now, whatever imperfections you feel you might have, or do have, obviously, take the slow, steady practice of devotional service, connection especially to these five items, because everyone's busy. Everyone has so many other demands on them. The Lord has been so kind to present these five and say, even if you have a little connection with them, you'll come to the perfect stage because they're so wonderful and so mysterious, they're difficult to understand. Kurnath Rule.
How do we live in Mathura? I mean, if we have these five items, right? I can understand, read Srimad Bhagavatam, associate with devotees, chant Hare Krishna, worship the deities. But living in Mathura seems like it's difficult for us here because we have duties here.
Yeah, living in Mathura, that's a real trick, isn't it? Well, you have to live somewhere, so you should live in Mathura. And Mathura is just outside Vrindavan. Vaikuntaj janito vara marupuri tatrapi rasotsava. There's different places you can, there's different realms you can live in. And they all have relative importance and potency. Rupa Goswami, Vaikuntas Janito Vara, Marupuri Tatrapi Rasosava, Vrindaranyam Udara Pani Ramana Tatrapi Govardhanaha, Radha Kunda Mihapi Gokulapate Primam Ritaplavanat, Kuryadasya Virajito, Kirite Sevam Viveki Nakaha. So he gives a progression of places. Vaikuntha, the Lord's personal abode, the official kingdom of God, that's what Vaikuntha is. That's according to Sanatana Goswami in the Brihat Bhagavata. Vaikuntha is the official kingdom of God. But there's something more than that. Vaikuntaj Janito Vara. Better than that, Janito Vara, Marupuri. There's Marupuri, there's Mathura. And above Mathura, did I skip one? Janito, yeah, it means the birthplace of Krishna. And then above that, Janito Vara Marupuri Tatrapi Rotsotsavad. Then he mentions the Mathura, then the forest of Vrindavan, because Krishna performed his pastimes in those various forests. And then he mentions the Govardhan Hill, because Krishna lifted Govardhan Hill. There's a lot to be said about all of these, of course. And then there's Radhakund. So there's a gradation of places one can live, and one should endeavor to live in Mathura. How can one do that? That's the question, right?
Should we just sell our houses and buy plane tickets and make some of, you know, get a condo there or something?
Not necessarily, because we may be ill-equipped to actually experience Mathura or to live there in such a way that we can benefit from the holy dham. It requires quite a bit of preparation. One of the best preparations for living in Mathura is to preach. To do Sankirtan, to go out and benefit others by broadcasting the holy name, to organize festivals so that people can come together and actually do Sankirtan, do congregational chanting, distribute books, and these kinds of things. This kind of austerity, according to Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur and according to His Divine Grace A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada, prepare the heart for actually living in Mathura. And Prabhupada mentioned many times in a practical way that these temples that are centered around all these activities of hearing and chanting and in which the deities are being worshipped, Radha and Krishna are here, is they're embassies of Mathura. Once, I probably mentioned this, but I went to the embassy in Calcutta for some passport issue or something like that. I had been in Calcutta for a couple of months, and I was totally in the Calcutta mode. I was even drinking Calcutta tap water at the time. I just thought, I'm going to be in Calcutta. I'm part of Calcutta. I could drink this water. And I did successfully. I had something to do with my passport. I walked in that embassy, and there were U.S. Marines inside. And I looked in, and I saw there was Arrowhead Springs bottled water. They were flying bottled water from America. Everything in there was American. With some American product, and I thought, that's America. That's amazing, because 2 inches, you know, past the door on the other side was Calcutta and Calcutta tap water, and on the other side was Arrowhead spring water, and I kept looking back and forth through the door thinking, America, Calcutta, Calcutta, America. And so in a similar way, these temples are in the mood of Mathura, especially when the hearing and chanting is going on and the Sankirtan movement is being spread. So one last point regarding the gateway to Mathura. We can't barge in to Mathura. We can't just barge in anywhere. We're dependent. In fact, you can't go anywhere. I've been hearing from devotees recently about trying to get visas to go to India. And it's very difficult, especially through the BLS. They're just horrible. It's the worst service in the world. But that's for a reason, because the material world is called Durga, difficult to go, and she's trying to keep up her reputation. It's very difficult to move around, get a visa, go anywhere. And so it's very difficult to move in this world. But if you go through the right channels, you can get your visa. For instance, if you happen to know somebody, and you just say, look, I got visa problems. Say, no problem, just give it to me, I'll take care of it, and they bring it back, right? So in the same way, in Kali Yuga, to approach Vrindavan and Mathura, you have to be in with Lord Chaitanya. There's no other way. Try to move here or there, try to go to Mathura, not possible. But if you attract the attention of Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, then Ese Brindaban Radhesham Pabe Darsham Gora Kripa Holehe. If you get the mercy of Lord Gora. So you do that by performing Sankirtan. So if you perform Sankirtan with abandon and focus your mind on that, worship the lotus feet of Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, Tirtasparam Shiva Vrinchi Nutam Sharanyam Brityardiham Pranatapala Pababdi Potam. Karabhajana Muni says, if you worship the lotus feet of Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, the Mahapurush, you get the result of going to all the holy places. And that's the way to enter Mathura. Do Sankirtan. Worship Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu in the authorized way. Then you become eligible. Then you get called to Mathura. And also then you can see Mathura in your own precincts. And that brings us to the end of our broadcast. Hare Krishna. And now we'll have a Guru Puja. So let's put away all the Shastra deities with great efficiency and reverence and all the asanas, and then we'll stand up and sing for the our founder Acharya. Srimad Bhagavatam ki jai, Srila Prabhupada ki jai, Gaur Bhaktivinoda ji ki jai, Go Premanande Haribo. Today we have opportunity of a beautiful day in November still for Sankirtan. There'll be several Sankirtan parties going out today to various places. And people, I think, are just waiting for us to show up. It's not that you have to know exactly what to do or say, because this is a form of yoga, going out to present transcendental literature. And Krishna gives instruction from the heart. A few tips are to be detached and compassionate, friendly, and to depend on Krishna. And just make a very straightforward and succinct presentation to people. Also, using humor is a very good idea, because people aren't that philosophically inclined. But if you're friendly and use a little bit of humor when you talk to people, one of the presentations, Bhrigupati Prabhu, who's a prolific book distributor, was showing me that he uses, for instance, on campus, when he meets a student, he says, "Are you a student? Do you go here?" And they say, "Yes." And he says, "Are you a good student?" And they say, "I think so." And then he says, "Great. We were asked to show these to all the deep thinkers." And then he hands them the book. He said, "What's your major?" And they'll say, "Name a major, someone." "Economics." And he say, "Okay, I'll show you the economics picture." And then he'll open up to the changing bodies and he says, "Here, here's the economics picture." And then then they laugh a little bit. You say, "Actually, this picture shows how the essence of life remains even after we leave the body, and it's there before we enter the body and so forth." And he says, "You've heard of karma before. What goes around comes around." And then very quickly just tells them that we just take a donation for the book, so give what you can. Like that. Yesterday, when we went to the San Francisco State campus, and there's a little grade that goes down to where the library is, where we usually work in front of the library. Just as I was going down there, I saw a woman coming up the hill, and she had some books under her arm, and one of them was the Bhagavad Gita as it is in paperback. And then I thought, there must be other devotees here distributing. So I said, I was about to hand her a Bhagavad Gita. I said, "Wait a minute, where'd you get that book?" And she said, "I got it at the store." And I said, "What store?" And she said, the bookstore at the library. I just bought it." And I said, "Really?" And she said, "Yeah, you should check it out. There's good books like this in the store." I said, "Well, I have the hardback right here, but I'll go take a look." And then I realized how living entities everywhere are actually searching for transcendental knowledge. She was, on her own volition, went in the store and bought it, and was going home with it to read that book. And in one way, people are in trance by the material nature, so we're going to break that trance and give them the formula that's clearly written to go back home, back to Godhead, and not linger here in the material world. So that's an opportunity today. Also, we have another huge opportunity, which is we get to take prasadam, I think. Is there prasadam today? I'm very grateful for that. And who were the cooks today? Kamala Mataji and team? Kamna. Oh, so they all cooked today? And do you know who was on the team? Huh? Pravesh? Pravesh also cooked? Anyone else? One-man team? Two-man team. Okay, so there'll be prasadam today. And then that'll be served just outside. And any other announcements? Thanks to all of you who have traveled from various locations. Yes. The question is, where are all the different locations for book distribution today? Malini, if you're online listening, please call in. Shri Krishna Purushottam sent an email. Foster City, of all places. Okay, so one place is in Foster City. Another is going to San Francisco, to Haight Street, Haight and Ashbury. Okay, tomorrow morning, not today. Okay, so today, Foster City. 766 Edgewater. Okay, will that be written somewhere so the devotees can pick it up? 766 Edgewater, okay. And roadside parking, how nice. Okay, so Foster City is a really good spot, actually. We went there a couple years ago when we were doing Chaitanya Charitamritas, and we did quite a few. People are very friendly. Shraddha lives there, her place is there, and it's an island, it's a little island. Kind of like Navadweep. Well, we can turn it into Navadweep by distributing books there. Everyone will be hearing and chanting. So that's available today also. Any other announcement or questions? Everyone's happy? Okay, good. Natari Armarman, Natari Armarman, Natari Armarman, Natari Armarman, Natari Armarman, Natari Armarman, Natari Armarman.